Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 11.
Hey everybody, on today's show we're going to talk about the history of the Shichigo-san Festival, and we're also going to get out of the studio and take a field trip to visit the Japanese Imperial Palace. Hi everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe, and I'm very excited about today's show because we are going to leave the studio and take a field trip to visit the Imperial Palace in the middle of Tokyo. So today's show is going to be about history, and we're going to take a walk through Japanese history with Mr. Paul Christie, who is the CEO of WalkJapan.com. And Walk Japan is a specialized tour company that takes people on historic, off-the-beaten-track walking tours of Japan. I've asked Paul to take us on a brief tour of the Imperial Palace. So we're going to be leaving the studio today, heading down to the Imperial Palace, which sits in the middle of Tokyo, and Paul's going to give us a brief tour explaining the significance and history of the Imperial Palace. So I'm really looking forward to that. That should be a lot of fun. But first, I am joined in the studio now by Juju Kurihara, who has the website idomegane.com. And Idomegane is a website documenting the history, culture, and festivals of Japan. Where do some of these things come from? How did they originally get started? So today we're going to be talking about the festival known as Shichigo-san. And this translates to English as 753. Kind of a weird title, but when you hear about the history of this festival, you'll understand why. Welcome to the studio, Juju.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So today we're going to be talking about the Japanese festival known as Shichigo-san, or 753, which comes around every November 15th. And what you'll see is many Japanese families taking their children, usually dressed in their kimonos and what you would call Sunday best, to the local shrine. Can you tell us what is the significance of the Shichigo-san festival?
Right. Shichigo-san is the age of kids at 3 years old, 5 years old, and 7 years old. We celebrate at that age, get to reach that age. Why? Well, before, ages ago, the kids in any other world, same, but the kids didn't grow. And they didn't grow like adult.
Why is that? Because of sickness?
Yeah, the sickness, maybe, mostly sickness, I guess, yeah. So it was really difficult for the parents to bring the kids up. Maybe they die when they are born or when they are really small. So Japanese people, they kind of started thinking that, okay, their kids, I mean, the little ones, they're actually not their kids. They're kind of, it's a little gift from the God, and they're kind of keeping them until they reach seven. So when they reach 7 years old, they bring their kids to the local jinja, like shrine, say thank you to the God. And then the shrine, they give a little, like a paper. I think a little piece of paper. It's called shijirei, I think. And means this paper, I mean, the receiving this paper means you're actually human.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's kind of ironic when you think about that. One of the big complaints that many gaijin have when they come to Japan is that everything seems to require a document or a certificate or some type of paperwork. Uh-huh. So you're saying that even in old traditional Japan, to become human,
right,
you need a documentation, a piece of paper from the shrine. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then you were classified as human. Sugoi.
Sugoi, yeah. Then the kids accept it in the society.
Right.
So this is like a passport. This is like a documentation to become a Japanese. No?
So when did this tradition get started? What period in Japanese history did they start doing this?
It was about like 8th century. It's called Heian period in Japan.
So that's, you know, long time ago. And you can kind of imagine back in 8th century Japan, it must have been difficult for families and children to keep their kids alive.
It's true, because we didn't have a good medication, and many people probably were born, but many died.
So that when a child reaches the age of 5, 7, or 3, it's, so it was quite significant back then.
Exactly.
And who practiced this originally?
It was done by, well, noble people like emperors, obviously, or aristocracy, or a little bit later, probably samurai society. Because, well, what happens is each age they celebrate in different, for example, kimono, or it actually cost. So normal people wouldn't or couldn't do that.
Oh, because it costs money to have a kimono, and normal people would not have that money?
Well, if you have a good one, like a really gorgeous kimono, right, it will cost.
Okay. So back then, only the aristocrats and nobles had the money to have a kimono, is that right?
Right.
Okay.
The beautiful ones, yes.
Right, okay.
Yes.
And what did this tradition involve back then? What did they do?
What did they do? Well, the origin of Shichigo-san, for example, the first, why it's 7, 5, and 3? Because it's a theory of yin yang. And the people thought odd numbers, they bring you good luck. So up to 7, the odd numbers are 3, 5, and 7. So they celebrate 3, 5, and 7. And also, there's a saying in Japan. It's called Yakudoshi. Yakudoshi, it's supposed to be a year, the age, that brings you bad luck.
Really?
Yeah.
What year is that? I think I must have experienced a lot of Yakudoshi in my lifetime. Is it age 20 to 39?
For men, it's 25, 42, and 61. And for women, 19, 33, and 37.
And these are years of bad luck?
It's supposed to be a bad luck. So it's kind of, it can, it's something bad things can happen. But it's quite superstitious. But people still, believe that. Then you have to be a bit cautious about that age. They wanted to celebrate, or they wanted to do some ceremony to get rid of the bad luck. That's another reason for celebrating 3, 5, and 7. And also, each celebration has different meanings. For example, at 3 years, at age of 3, it's called Kamioki, the celebration of Kamioki. Kami is a hair, and oki means like to leave. To leave the hair means, traditionally, the boy, especially for boys, before age of 3, they didn't grow the hair. They kind of shaved the head off. Well, they shaved the hair off.
Right.
Apart from some certain part. And they left a little bit of hair, but the rest, they shave.
Why did they do that?
Because they believe that from the hair, they can get diseases or bad things.
Okay.
So if they don't have the little ones, they don't have hair, they don't get any diseases.
Right.
That's why they they shaved.
Girls and boys or just boys?
I don't think they had long hair, but according to some document, they said they also, the girls also shaved the hair. Mm-hmm. But most of the pictures or some series and things like that, you can only see the boys have no hair. Then when they reach 3 years old, they celebrate this kamioki, the celebration of kamioki, and then start growing their hair. And then the hair they grow is called dohatsu. Do is a kid. Hatsu is a hair. So it's a type of hair for kids. It's also called in nowadays, it's also called okappa. It's like the Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction, you know, like traditional Japanese doll, if you've seen it.
That movie Kill Bill?
Yeah, possible. It's, you know, they have a really straight fringe and the back of the hair is about like the top of the neck.
Okay.
The really straight cut. That sort of style of hair. So that's the celebration for 3 years old. And then when they reach 5 years old, it's for celebration for boys, not the girls. At age of five, the boys started wearing hakama.
What's a hakama?
Hakama is it's a type of kimono for men.
Okay.
It's like trousers, kimono trousers. And it started because of one of the shogun, his name is Tsuneyoshi Tokugawa, the fifth Tokugawa shogun.
Okay.
Uh-huh. He had a son, it's called Tokumatsu. And when he reached 5 years old, the shogun decided to celebrate for him. Then they put him in hakama. It's said that that was the origin of hakamagi, the celebration of hakamagi.
Okay.
Yep. So it's the same. 5 years old, you can only see boys.
So the girls celebrate at three, boys celebrate at five.
Five, uh-huh.
What's the seven, significance of the seven?
Seven, okay. Seven is for the girls, again. Seven, it's called a celebration of obitoki. Obi is a belt, okay. Like kimono belt.
Right.
And toki is to get rid of. Right, okay. Sounds really funny. Up to 7 years old, the little ones also wore kimono, but they wore easy ones, not the kimono that now we see, you know, the Michael.
Many layered. Yeah,
exactly. And many belts and beautiful belts. Now the kids don't wear that thing.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. They wore simple ones. There are some different stages, but the most of them, they have only like a strings. They tie the kimono with a string. But when they reach 7 years old, they get rid of that string and then started putting a beautiful belt.
Okay. So they, at age seven, they can start to wear what looks more like a full traditional kimono.
Exactly. Still a bit simpler, but yeah, it looks like a formal kimono.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is to celebrate that they've gotten their sheet of paper and they are now people, Japanese people.
Yes, exactly. So now they can be recognized as a part of society.
Are there any special foods that people eat during this celebration?
The most famous one is a candy. It's called chitose ame.
Okay.
Ame is a candy.
Right.
Chitose is 1,000 years.
I mean, the candy's like 1,000 years old, or they hope the child lives 1,000 years? How does moldy piece of candy now that you've reached adulthood?
Yeah, I mean, every age person lick it. No. No, you wouldn't eat that. Well, no, this is like a normal stick candy. Normally white and pink.
Right.
Uh-huh. And it comes with comes in a little bag. It's kind of pretty. And maybe some drawing. Well, for celebrating things, Japanese people do like turtles and crane.
Why is that?
It's said that they are the animals live really, really long. For example, turtles. They say turtles live 10,000 years and cranes live 1,000 years.
Okay. So they give the children this candy decorated with turtles and cranes to symbolize a long, healthy life in Japan.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
What's the candy made out of?
I don't know. It's I remember it wasn't really tasty. It didn't have... Yeah. Really? I never... Yeah. Actually, I never liked it. Yeah.
Maybe that's why it's called a thousand-year-old candy, because everyone is passing it down generation to generation. No one wants to eat it.
That's possible. It tastes like flour.
Okay.
With sugar or something like that. Yeah. I tried, but I never liked it.
So if someone was in Japan and they wanted to go see the Shichigo-san festival, where would you suggest they go?
Well, if you are in Tokyo, maybe Meiji Jingu, you will see many kids. I would think so.
And Meiji Jingu is the shrine that's near Harajuku Station?
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm.
Yep. If you're in other parts of Japan, any major shrine will have this festival going on?
I think, but in theory, they go to the local one.
Okay.
So, yeah, so you can find any bigger shrine in the local area.
Right.
And then they can, I mean, you can see the kids going.
That's great.
Uh-huh.
Well, thanks, Juju. Thanks for coming on the show and telling us about the Shichigo-san Festival.
Thank you.
If you want to find out more about her website, which deals with all sorts of history and culture in Japan, check out idomegane.com, and I will provide a link to that from my website at tokyopodcast.com. Today I'm joined by Mr. Paul Christie, who is the CEO of Walk Japan, which is a premium tour company specialized in off-the-beaten-track walking tours throughout Japan. Today he's leading us on a short tour of the historic Imperial Palace. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Oh, hello. Thanks for welcoming me along.
No problem. So can you tell us today, what are we going to see?
Well, we've come to what is almost the heart of the old Shogun's Palace in Tokyo, which is now part of the Imperial Palace grounds, although there's bits open to the public. And this is essentially where the power of Japan was held for about 300 years, from the early 1600s to almost the end of the 19th century. And this would have been Japan's forbidden palace, although it's never described in those terms. It would have been very difficult for people to have got this far unless you were very senior in that society at the time.
But now most of it's open to the public?
Well, what is now the Imperial Palace and what is the castle grounds is actually just the core element. The castle... That is about 5 kilometres around. The castle itself was actually 16 kilometres in circumference. That included some many things, not just the shogun's apartments, but barracks, armouries, treasuries, and many of the senior daimyo. These are the senior samurai daimyo from the regions, the barons, if you like, of Japan. Those days had housing within the castle grounds as well, and beyond that as well. I mean, what is Tokyo today was known as Edo in the Shogun period, in the samurai period, and it was a male city. It was a city which was about at least two-thirds, if not more, three-quarters male, and there's very good reasons for that. It was the military, and the military's power was focused on Tokyo.
Can you tell us about the stonework that we see surrounding the the palace?
Mm-hmm. The stonework, of course, is some of the best you'll see in Japan. There are many, many castles built around Japan. many of which do have good stonework, but the difference is here, the scale is enormous. Not just that some of the individual stones, but just the amount of stonework that would have been necessary for a palace that's 16 kilometres in circumference. And what is nice about modern Tokyo is if you know where to look, not just in this area, which is sort of relatively preserved, but also amongst the modern buildings, in places you'll find the old stonework if you know where to go. Yeah. And there are lots of reminders of the old castle. But like so many things, if it's not pointed out to you, if you're not aware of it,
right. It
very often you don't really think about it. You might see it, but it doesn't enter into your consciousness so much, more of a subconscious thing. So we're coming up to the top of a little rise here as we've passed through a number of sort of stone rampart areas, which would have been gates, fortifications to protect the shogun, who would have been living in this area. What is now a park, grassland, trees, bushes, was in fact largely buildings in the past. The shogun's apartments and the shogun's harem was also in this area. Over there, the far corner over there, you can see quite a large stone structure. That's actually the base of what was Edo Castle's tower, called a Tenshu Kaku in Japanese. And there was three built on that site. The first three shoguns, to try and show their strength. The first shogun, Tokugawa Ieyasu, of the Edo period, was probably the greatest figure in Japanese history. And then his sons came along, took over, his son and then grandson. And I suppose in a way of trying to show their not as, you know, they're as strong as their father or grandfather, they rebuilt, one way of doing it is to rebuild the Tenshu Kaku, the tower. But the third one was burnt down and they never bothered building another one. At the time, one of the retainers, the advisors of the shogun, said, because large parts of it had been burnt down at the same time, it's not a good idea to build that while other people in the city are struggling. Be better to.
Why was it burnt down? War?
Well, Edo was known as a city of fire. Fires were a regular part of life here, and great swathes of the city were burnt down. Now, the last time that happened was actually in 1945. In a large number of people were died in the bombing of Tokyo, fire bombing of Tokyo. Mm. More so than either Nagasaki or Hiroshima.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a little known fact, but yes, over a period of about, it didn't all happen at once, over a period of about 3 months,
right.
Large parts of the city disappeared in flames.
Wow.
So anyway, here we are, and unfortunately there's nothing left of the shogun's buildings here. Mm. We've seen one or two barrack buildings, which have probably been reconstructed recently. But luckily in Kyoto, at Nijiojo Castle, there are still the shogun's apartments. So if you go there, you get an idea of what it would have been like here, although here the scale would have been much bigger than in Kyoto.
Right.
Essentially, they really didn't use the apartments, the castle there in Kyoto, because they wanted to show their strength. They didn't need Kyoto, which is where the emperor is, which is where, if you like, the tradition of Japan is, even in those days. Edo's a new brash city. It's where the power is. It's where the money is.
Right.
It's where you needed to be if you're going to get anywhere in this society for most people in those days. And what I find interesting is, of course, after the Meiji Restoration, which is when the Tokugawa family were swept aside, the old samurai system was swept aside, and they brought in a modern state, they moved the capital to Tokyo, what became known as Tokyo. And Tokyo means eastern capital. So Beijing is northern, Nanjing is southern. I don't know whether there's a west capital. Kyoto just means capital. But what they also did was they never ever announced that the capital moved to Tokyo. What they did was they got the Meiji Emperor, who was in Kyoto originally, to visit the new Tokyo every now and again. And the people in Kyoto worried about this because they thought maybe the capital would be taken away from them. Because the capital was always in Kyoto from the time it left Nara, essentially, until the 1870s, 1880s, with the 200s. Well, yeah, essentially it was in Kyoto all that period. And then, for some reason, the authorities decided to make Edo the capital, called Tokyo, but they've never actually announced it, ever.
No, really?
The Meiji Emperor just didn't go back to Kyoto.
No, really?
So it was done very Japanese way of
Well,
this is how it is. Yes, but yes, sort of. And everyone just thought, oh, okay, that's
here
it.
We are. Yeah.
They made an announcement; it would be a problem, so they didn't make an announcement.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a great oasis in the middle of this bustling city.
Right.
You look over in the distance; you can see some of the modern buildings of the city, business districts, and the like. And then here it is. And as I say, many Tokyo people in Tokyo do not really know this is here, although today it's lovely weather and there are quite a few people around. But if you look closely, actually a lot of them are foreigners who are interested in the history of the city. Now, I mentioned Kyoto being the capital and Edo being the power base of the country for this long period from about 1600 to 1603. The city itself, at least by European standards, is not that old. It's only about 500 years old. Even by Japanese standards, many cities in Japan are much older. Kyoto is much older, 1,200 years. Nara is even older. Osaka is a much older city. So why did it become this one of the great cities of the world? Is, well, partly because of the Tokugawa shogun building it up. And the reason they built it up is because they needed to establish their authority on the country. Going to Kyoto or Osaka would have been partly out of their territory. This was their territory. It was given to them by a previous powerful figure called Hideyoshi, Toyotomi Hideyoshi. And I think it was relatively easy to defend. There's really only sort of two ways into the city, sort of from the north or from the east. And I think that was a good reason to keep their power base here. And they spent a lot of time and energy building an enormous city in a very short space of time, maybe 10, 15 years, to go from what was just a small, essentially a marshy area with a small castle on top of this mound here that we're at, to the basis of not just the modern city of today, but the basis of a dictatorship that controlled Japan very successfully for 270 odd years. And it was successful in many ways, not least there wasn't much in the way of warfare, and so essentially a peace reigned. And because the peace reigned, other things, energy and money, could be put into other things such as culture. So there's a flowering of culture during this period, the Edo culture, which includes things like kabuki theatre, which today is quite a difficult thing to understand, but in its day it was popular. It was of the people. Things like printmaking, those prints of, you know, the waves sort of lapping over Mount Fuji, or the cherry blossom in bloom in wherever. This all comes from this Edo period, and in fact the greatest practitioners of the art were based in Edo.
If that period was a relatively calm period, what caused the downfall of the Tokugawa then? Why did people want change?
Well, I think like anywhere, there's always somebody who wants change because they're not necessarily in a position of power, or they don't have enough power, they feel suppressed. And that's certainly what happened in Japan as well, of course. It was a dictatorship. If you were friends of the Tokugawa shogunate, you were in a good position. If you weren't, you're in a less good position. So you have to remember that the shogun was all powerful. Everything was controlled by the shogun. If you had any connection with the shogun, you're a samurai and connected to the shogun, even no matter how distantly, either physically or in terms of relationship, you know, how many degrees removed from the center, you had great sway in the society. The reason it started to crumble was really the advent of foreigners coming here. Now, Japan was effectively closed off to the rest of the world. There were the Dutch in Nagasaki on an island, but they were insignificant in terms of affecting wider society. The shogun had complete control over what was going on there. So the Dutch were bringing in, basically they were for trade, but also bringing in knowledge of the West, scientific technology, medicine and things like that. Well, that was directly controlled by the shogunate. So that wasn't a threat because they had the information first. But what was happening was that the Russians, the Americans, other countries, perhaps the English to some extent, were trying to get a foothold here for whatever reason. But to cut a long story short, the Tokugawa started to make deals with these people, which showed, as far as the rest of Japan was concerned, that the Tokugawa was actually weak. It wasn't as strong as they perhaps perceived. So it's like they could start seeing cracks in the foundations of this dictatorship. And I think that's the best way to look at it. And so these other people, other samurai who were not friends of the shogunate, started to send their youngest and best off secretly to the West to start studying all sorts of things, from politics to economics to military affairs and the like, aided and abetted by some merchants who'd managed to be established in Nagasaki as a Scotsman called Glover, who was helping the clans antithetical to the shogunate to, he was getting money for it, but he was providing them with the means to get their young and best offshore, to go to Europe, to go to North America. And in fact, it's these young guys who end up running the country soon after the Meiji Restoration in 1869, when the Tokugawa shogunate fell, right, and the modern Japan started to arise.
See, who was the first group of foreigners who came to Japan? Was it the Dutch?
No, the Portuguese, in about 1542. And they landed at a place called Tanigashima, which is where Japan's modern-day space program is located, just south, on an island just south of the southern end of Kyushu.
And how were they welcomed? Were they welcomed with open arms, or were they feared?
I think they were welcomed with open arms. In those days, Japan wasn't a closed country at all.
Right.
What they were bringing things like muskets, rifles with them.
Right.
Which the military wanted to get hold of course.
Right.
They also brought Christianity, and the Japanese weren't too bothered about Christianity. They thought it was probably quite interesting. In fact, one of the great leaders of Japan during this period is Nobunaga, Oda Nobunaga. And although he wasn't a Christian, he did have a seminary in the grounds of his castle, which was near Lake Biwa, just the east of modern-day Kyoto. But also what they were bringing was wealth. They wanted to trade. So many of the regional barons, the daimyo, wanted to have these people in their provinces because it meant they would make money from it. And very often those daimyo did become Christian. And this is particularly true of Kyushu area, modern-day Kyushu, and western Honshu, Yamaguchi Prefecture, places like that.
What did Japan offer in trade?
They had a lot of copper and silver.
Japan had a lot of copper.
Yeah, and they were in the early days. That's what they would be trading with. So here we are, where the Tenshukaku, the keep, the tower would have been. It's a shame in a way that it's not here, because this would have been the biggest feature of Edo, and indeed it would probably have been of Tokyo if it's still here. It would have been the symbol of Tokyo. One of the reasons the castle was built here, and one of the reasons it was so big, was not just because this guy was... Partly, it worked both ways. He wasn't just the most powerful man in the land. He had to actually show that. There are two main roads coming into Edo. One's called the Nakasendo, one's called the Tokaido. Many people have heard of the Tokaido. And these roads connect Edo with, essentially, Kyoto. And many people would be travelling into Edo along those two roads. And the end point is just over to the east, in a place called Nihonbashi, which now today is a big shopping business district. And apparently, there's no buildings here now, it's difficult to tell, but apparently as you were arriving at Nihonbashi, the castle would be looming essentially above you. It was to say, now you've arrived, this is where the gods live,
right?
And don't mess with it.
Right.
That's what it's telling you. It was all about overwhelming power, and not just the actual power which they had, but also the image of that power.
Right.
Another good example is the shogun's Nikko, north of Tokyo, where the Tokugawa shoguns, particularly the first three, are enshrined. They become deities. And if you ever go there, you'll see something which is quite un-Japanese in its architecture. And it's this idea of, this is not Japan. This is where your leaders come from. This is who you're dealing with, all right? So to absolutely quell any idea that you could ever...
be on the same level.
Yeah, and feel that you could overthrow these people.
Right.
I mean, all countries do. I mean, Britain did it in the way it used to build
buildings, and if you went to London, there would be buildings. You had Africa House, you had Canada House. Oh, they still exist, but it's just say, yes, this is the centre of the world. You cannot do any better than this. Of course, right. You know, it crumbles eventually, right, as right. It did here.
Right, yeah. Right.
Quite a view that is not what you would expect in Tokyo. Most people's image of Tokyo is something else. So that what we're doing with our Tokyo tour is to tell a story of Tokyo and bring it alive, because many people think it's a modern city, which it is, and may or may not like that. Most people are not particularly interested. But once you get into the history, it starts to tell a great story. This is a great city because of its history as much as anything else.
And also, too, I like the fact that in Tokyo you have this modern city, but like you said, like in the Nihonbashi area, you can find remnants of the old tucked away here
Absolutely,
and there.
Yeah.
But if you don't know what you're looking for, it's easy to walk past that.
Absolutely. So what we do is we, on the tour, we'll start telling the story from, if you like, the shogun's perspective, because that's why it happened. Without the Tokugawa, without the shogun, one and the same, Tokyo wouldn't exist. Then we talk about, if you like, the townspeople's lives. And that's just as fascinating. Tokyo's a modern city. There weren't many people here. Edo, should say, was a modern city in the sense that nothing else was here much before that. So people had to come, be brought from all over Japan to build the city. So they brought many, many, tens of thousands of craftsmen were brought to the city. So it was, it's like Kyoto, which today even has a tradition that stretches back a long, long time. Edo doesn't have that, and it was people from all over, including Kyoto, came here to build the city, to earn a living. The what is now one of the big department stores called Mitsukoshi actually has its roots in a merchant store from Kyoto. What they did was send the second son to Tokyo to start a business here, which developed into one of the great department stores of the world.
How long have you guys been running tours here in Japan?
For about 20 years now, so we're, in the scheme of things, we're long established. And it all came out of academic work that the two founding partners, Tom Stanley and Dick Irving, did. They were both at Hong Kong University, professor of Japanese history and professor of Japanese social geography. So they brought their students to Japan to walk along one of these old highways, the Nakasendo Way, which runs from Kyoto to what was Edo, modern-day Tokyo. They walked along some of the nicest parts and were studying the people, the history, talking about this, that and the other. And it's an excellent way to get to know what I would argue is the real Japan, if you like. And that tour, that became a tour for people in general, not just students, and has been extremely successful. We get an awful lot of custom for that tour now, and we ran them throughout the year. We even have a summer version in the heat and the humidity. And we have a winter version where there's lots of snow. Great fun. And now we have about 10 or 12 different scheduled tours throughout the year, covering Hokkaido to Kyushu.
Are they all walking tours?
Those are. We also have many other tours. We do a lot of custom tours, so people come to us and say, this is what we want to do. It may or may not include walking. They might say, we want to eat a lot, so we have a gourmet tour. And we do tours for a number of other organisations who rely on our expertise in the country to create something interesting for them. Because of our background, academic background, because of people like myself and my colleagues who have a great interest and a long experience with Japan, I've been associated with the place 25 years now, we're able to provide, I think, a very good sort of picture, a reality of Japan, which often is overlooked in tours to Japan, which is a bit of a shame, because it's good for Walk Japan, but it's a bit of a shame for people in general, because I think the real beauty of this country is its people, and it's really its daily life. It's great to see some of these fantastic icons of Japan, like the Golden Pavilion Temple in Kyoto, like the giant Buddha in Kamakura. These are fantastic. But I think they're really, in a sense, overshadowed by the people themselves, who are really kind, really helpful. They'll go out of their way to help you. You feel very safe here, and they're very pleasant people to be around, and they're very interested in foreigners coming to see their place. In fact, they're flabbergasted anyone would be that interested, but it is extremely interesting. I happen to live in a very remote part of Japan, in Kyushu, called Kunisaki. Most Japanese have never heard of it.
And it is fabulous. And the people are ecstatic when we do tours there as well. Ecstatic when we bring people through. In fact, we've got a tour going on there at the moment, and the people who are now very happy on that tour, and the people who they meet. And that's what we try to do. We try to get them as close to the Japanese as possible. We don't have much in the way of looking out a window, a bus window, looking at Japan at arm's length. We actually get people into Japan. And we're successful enough that some people come back with us on the fourth tour.
I think that that's a bit of a challenge for some people coming to Japan, isn't it? Is that Japan has this, obviously, this very extensive train network, but let's face it, there's not a lot of English on that network, so it's very easy to kind of fall into the regular tourist route. Up on the Shinkansen bullet train, go to Kyoto, see the temple, come back. But you miss out on so much when you do that.
Absolutely. So this is why I think one of the reasons we've been very successful is because people go away. First of all, maybe it's a 12-day tour, and they go away feeling they've been here a lot longer for all the right reasons. They phrases like, this is much more than I expected, is not unusual at the end of our tours, which is, of course, great. It's great. It's a pleasure for us to provide tours that people like so much. But it's a great pleasure that we know these people are leaving Japan often most frequently with the desire to come back again, whether with us or on their own, which is what it's all about. I think, you know, I came to this country and I was only going to be here 1 year, and now I'm in my 25th year. And I think that says something. It is a country which I think has a great deal to please many, many different people. But it's very much underrated in that way. The Japanese don't realize that they're the biggest sales point of their own country. Yeah, I think that's what we're trying to, through our work, trying to, if you like, underscore the warmth and the honesty and the helpfulness of these people, because that's what we want people to enjoy, amongst other things. Because we know that the Japanese aren't doing it, and we want to encourage them to do a bit more. Yeah.
If people want to check out more of your services, they can look at walkjapan.com. And thank you, Paul. Thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me along.
Thanks again to both my guests for coming on the show. I really enjoy listening and studying about the history of Japan, because I feel that the history of Japan can tell us a lot about how Japan is today. So this is a series that I hope to continue and have more guests on the show. If you want to find out more about the Shichigo-san Festival, visit Juju's website at idomegane.com. And if you are planning on holiday to Japan, I would highly recommend taking a walking tour, because it really is one of the best ways to see the country. And you can find out all about Paul's service at walkjapan.com. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.